BDNG podcast. My name is Tina McKenzie and I am the Education Development Lead for the BDNG. I hope you enjoy listening to the BDNG podcast and find them beneficial to your practice. These podcasts are sponsored by Amaril. Amaril has no influence over the content of these podcasts. Happy listening.
Good afternoon or good morning, everyone. My name is Molly Conley and I am one of the education nurses. And today's podcast is going to be about mast cell action and a little bit about MCAS as well. So for today's podcast, we've got Deborah, who's going to tell us a little bit more about mast cell action as well as MCAS. So Deborah, would you just mind maybe introducing yourself and a little bit about your role, please?
Yes, thank you so much, Molly. Thank you so much for having me today. So my name is Deborah Burcham and I am the community support lead at Mast Cell Action. And basically my role includes the creation of resources and learning and training for healthcare professionals and also for members of our community who are living with MCAS. So we provide a lot of self-help resources and information, but also training and support and information for clinicians. And I do a lot of webinars and talks, and I host the podcast and the Wellbeing Advisory Board. So lots of different varied aspects to my job.
And for people who might not know what MCAS is, can you kind of just briefly explain what it is and what that abbreviation means?
Yeah, so MCAS is mast cell activation syndrome, and it's an immunological condition. So it's part of the immune system, the mast cells, which are blood cells, and they're part of the immune system, and they live throughout the body. They're in every body system, and particularly in the membranes where we interface with the outside world. So obviously the skin is one of the largest areas where mast cells live, but also the mucous membranes in the mouth and the eyes and the nose, the digestive tract. But they're also very closely paired with the nervous system. They're in the heart, the lungs, the brain. So completely spread throughout the body, and they act as the first defenders, if you like, really, of the immune system. So their job is to spot a potential problem, an invader or a wound, and they respond to that by releasing large numbers of chemicals called mediators. And the latest count is that there's probably over 1,000 different mediator chemicals that are released by these cells. And most of those chemicals are pro-inflammatory. So their job is to attack the invader with the inflammation, or to trigger inflammation to help with wound healing. And also as signaling molecules. So they signal to the rest of the immune system to pile on and get involved. So they're that first response, really, and they're supposed to activate to an invader, like an infection, like a bacterial infection or a viral infection, a sting or, you know, an insect bite, and to wounds, as I've said, to help trigger that inflammatory cascade that is supposed to happen and is supposed to be helpful. But in MCAS, somebody who's got mast cell activation syndrome, it means that those mast cells have become overactivated. So they start to release their inflammatory chemicals inappropriately without any obvious trigger, or in response to triggers that wouldn't normally, you know, be considered dangerous, like foods, like the toiletries that we use or the cleaning products, potentially, you know, exercise and movement, temperature changes, atmospheric changes, all sorts of things can start to trigger those mast cells when they become dysregulated in MCAS. So people are then experiencing these very widespread inflammatory or allergic type symptoms in all areas of their body, because as we said, the mast cells are everywhere. So it leads to a really a myriad, a constellation of different symptoms. And for a diagnosis, the criteria is two different body systems at least must be involved for it to be considered potentially MCAS. So people would need problems in their bladder and their skin, or their gut and migraines, for example. But most people with MCAS have lots of problems in all over their body systems, in multiple systems. So that's the kind of brief definition of MCAS.
And it might be a bit hard and difficult to put a number on it, but do we know roughly how many people in the UK are affected? And is it a specific, for example, would it be only children or would it be only adults? Do we have kind of any information on that?
Yes, so the short answer is no, we don't have a specific number yet, because there is now a SNOMED code within the NHS, a clinical code that MCAS can be coded to, but that's quite a new introduction. So there hasn't been up until now, figures collected, and there isn't a registry at the moment for figures within the UK, for example. And historically, it's been quite difficult to get that figure because it's quite a new condition. It was only sort of formally recognised around the sort of 2010, 2011. That's globally. So, the research is still catching up. The ability to diagnose and treat it is not yet widespread within the NHS. There's no clear clinical pathways, no commissioned services. So we're still at the very early stages of getting the condition recognised and diagnosed. So there are lots of people potentially who haven't been diagnosed yet. So it's difficult to say a specific figure. There has been studies done, sort of epidemiological studies. In Germany, there was one done that showed that up to potentially 17% of the population potentially have a sort of mast cell, activation disorder. So the studies are showing that it's much more prevalent and much more common than was previously believed. But, we don't have specific figures. But as I said, now we are able to code it and it is becoming, better recognised. We're hoping that figures will eventually come from that. And you asked about, whether it happens from childhood or whether it develops in adulthood. So, again, we don't really know what causes it. There are studies that show that there are potential genetic abnormalities in people with MCAS. That research is growing. And we do think that there's a genetic component because we see it in families. It's very common for someone who has MCAS to have a parent, a grandparent, a child with MCAS as well. So we do see this familial picture. So there is clearly some genetic component, and some people are born with it. They're poorly from babies, they're very sick in childhood with lots of asthma and eczema and food intolerances. And, they have that MCAS picture very clearly from the beginning. For other people, they may have a genetic predisposition, maybe, but they would say, well, I was perfectly well until adulthood. And then, I had COVID or I caught some other, food poisoning. We see it developing in people after an infection, an assault, if you like, on the immune system, and or after, medical procedure, something very traumatic as well, a very stressful event. All of these things seem to affect the immune system, what we might call stressors, not just mental stressors, but physical stressors as well, seem to affect the immune system in people that maybe have this genetic predisposition. As I've said, the research on that is still coming, but that's the kind of pattern we see. So people do very much start with it, in adulthood. That's quite common from a sensitizing event, if you like, happens. And then suddenly they find that they've become intolerant to lots of things. They're having all these allergic type symptoms that they never had before. And we're seeing very much more of it since COVID. And I know that when I go to events, it's often the clinicians working in the long COVID clinics who are most interested to talk to me because they're seeing it a lot in their population of people. So there is research and studies now that are showing that there's potentially a mast cell involvement in what we're calling long COVID, and a lot of people in our community became sick as a result of COVID.
And with your kind of charity, can you explain a little bit about what that charity is, what it does? And I kind of assume this is also related to about the difficulty in gaining a diagnosis, not only maybe for people living with it, but maybe for healthcare professionals supporting that patient through whatever journey that it takes them to get that diagnosis or that label or that investigation or whatever it is they might need at the end of that journey.
Yes, absolutely. So Mast Cell Action was set up in December 2015 by three people who had been affected. They either had MCAS themselves or they had a loved one with MCAS. And they realised that it was a very difficult picture nationally to get recognition and treatment for this condition. And so they set up Mast Cell Action. And our mission is to support everybody who is affected by MCAS, and that is obviously the patients themselves, their carers, their loved ones, but also the researchers and the clinicians, the doctors who are working with people with MCAS. So we provide support for all of those people through the charity, and we do that in a number of ways. As I said, we do have clinician education and resources for clinicians. So if doctors and healthcare professionals, nurses are seeing MCAS in their patients, if they're starting to think, oh gosh, I think I'm seeing this, but I don't really know what to do for this person, I don't really know how to help them, then they're very welcome to reach out to us. We provide support to individuals, but also we deliver information webinars to health trusts and to different departments, so we can help with education. And we have resources that are free to download from our website. So we have recently published the comprehensive primary care guide, which is useful for all healthcare professionals, really. So that's free to download from our website, and that gives you information about the diagnostic criteria that are in place, how to identify MCAS, and how to go about the testing, where the testing is available, that sort of thing. And people can email us as well. So our email address, info@mastcellaction.org. We're very happy to help clinicians if they want to reach out to us with queries and issues. And we also provide a lot of support for people who are living with MCAS. So we have resources aimed at the community as well. So, you know, self-help, this self-management toolkit, things like that, that help people to make lifestyle and dietary changes. So we offer a lot of support about with that, with resources. We do free webinars and free events with clinicians, for clinicians, and also for the community. So we have tailored exercise for people with MCAS who are struggling. Maybe we do lots of social things. Every Thursday night there's a peer support group, so there's a lot of support available through us. There's also a Facebook group where people find really, really helpful. So you can also signpost your patients to us to get help and support through our services. And they can also email us at that info@mastcellaction.org email address. If somebody is wanting to find a clinician to get a diagnosis, we don't have a sort of a list, as it were, that we can send out, but we know we have a very big network of people within the UK who we know are aware of and are working with MCAS. So if people email in to us and say, I've got these sorts of symptoms and I'm in this kind of area of the country, we can try and match them up with somebody, and we can share details of the clinicians who've given us permission to do that. So that's if somebody is struggling and wants a diagnosis, that's probably the best step that I would encourage them to do. So yes, we provide a range of different support for people who are at different stages, if they're wanting the diagnosis at the very early stage, but also further on, about how to live with and manage MCAS, and also for loved ones as well. We have information and support for people who are caring for someone who has MCAS, because that's also very challenging.
And I think, as you mentioned about the way that MCAS works with all the different signalers in the different parts of the body. So I think for us as dermatology nurses, obviously we might be a bit more interested in skin symptoms, maybe more so than, let's say, brain symptoms or GI symptoms or things like that. Are these resources, or would there be resources that would be useful, for example, for us as nurses to know, if we're in our clinic and we're thinking, oh, maybe, but I'm not really allowed to put an official diagnosis on it, but maybe this just might help them manage, even if it's not MCAS as such, it might give them some ideas or tips. You know what I mean by that?
Absolutely. So of course, we're not suggesting that people just give people diagnoses of MCAS, and it's a complex thing, and it is difficult for clinicians when they're faced with that in their clinic, and maybe thinking, oh gosh, I'm just here for the skin, I'm not here to get involved in all of that. But actually, it's really useful to have that bigger picture of someone who you're working with, even in a just a dermatological context, because MCAS is a whole body condition, and it affects the way that somebody you're working with may respond to the interventions that you're doing. They may, be reacting to plasters or dressings or creams that you're using. They might, be reacting to medications that you would, so the standard dermatological protocols that you may be implementing, you might see that they're not responding in the right way to that, or the expected way. Or, and this is where it's really useful to have that awareness, even if it's not diagnosed, even if you don't say it out loud, but you just know in the back of your mind, this person has lots of symptoms other than skin conditions that might be an MCAS picture. It then helps you to think, well, I'll go for the very sensitive options. I'll go for the fragrance-free stuff. I'll suggest that they onboard their creams or whatever in very small doses, and I'll do patch testing first, or, so you can tailor your treatment protocol in a way that you would be thinking a very, very sensitive, very allergic type patient. How would you approach that slightly differently, maybe? And if they then say to you, oh gosh, I used this cream or whatever, and I came up in this massive rash, you won't be really shocked by that. You'll be like, oh, okay, I understand what's happening there. They've maybe had some kind of reaction to that. And so, that can be very helpful. And so just the general clinician guidelines, the as I said, the comprehensive healthcare professional guide, I'd really recommend you read that anyway, just because it's so useful to give you that bigger picture of what you might see in an MCAS patient in your clinic, and how you might tailor some of your interventions, and also who you might then refer to if you do have that suspicion, because there isn't a referral pathway that's clearly laid out. There isn't a commissioned service of MCAS doctors that you can refer to. But as I said, within lots of different specialities around the country, there are people who have a special interest in MCAS. So you might then, through contacting us, through getting some information from us, through looking at our resources, you might find a way to get them plugged into, someone who can support them with MCAS.
And I think sometimes, it depends on the department, but in quite a lot of departments, dermatology nurses might have a longer time with the patient. They might be spending, doing those investigations, like you said, like patch testing. It might be that they're helping that patient with the creams. So what would kind of be, I guess, either from a charity perspective or maybe as a patient perspective, kind of top three tips that you might give nurses maybe working with this patient group, things that we, you know, could help with that we should be aware of, you know, how can we maybe support this patient group, especially when there's not a lot of things known about this condition?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's really critical because it's so difficult for doctors, you know, in their 10 minutes. MCAS is such a complex condition and there are so many variable aspects of it that people often feel very sort of, you know, inadequately supported, if you like, because they have so many issues. So having that little bit of extra time to be able to support someone is really, really valuable for the patient, I think. And so I would say that lifestyle interventions are one of the key things that that can help somebody with MCAS. So if they can see a helpful clinician, and this is one thing to bear in mind, that you don't necessarily need a diagnosis as a patient in order to get help with MCAS. So if, you know, it can be well managed in primary care, H1 blockers, antihistamines, H2 blockers, even the mast cell stabilizers in some areas of the UK are available to be prescribed at primary care level. So it might be that, you know, just getting them plugged into some prescriber support like that and helping them to get on to some antihistamines even can be really helpful. But that's not the whole piece. It's actually more about what the client, the patient themselves is able to do. So one of our key things is to keep a symptom diary and a symptom log and record what you eat, but also more broadly, you know, what you do in a day, if you've exercised, if you've been out to a particular place, if you've drunk coffee, if you have, you know, breathed in some perfumes, if you've done cleaning on a particular day and used some products, make a little note and record that, and then record your symptoms, what happens and how you feel, because this is the best way for someone to be able to start to understand their triggers, because everybody with MCAS has different triggers. We said, you know, that the immune system starts to respond to things inappropriately, but that's different for everybody. For somebody it might be strawberries and bananas and fragrance, and for somebody else it might be vape smoke and bleach. You know, everybody's going to have different things that are aggravating their mast cells. And one of the key things is to help somebody understand their triggers. So even just having that conversation with someone and just asking, have you noticed any patterns in your symptoms, might be worth keeping a little diary and just seeing, because that can be the first stage in helping somebody to really understand this is being triggered by something that I'm eating or something environmental, and then they can take steps to avoid those triggers, and that is a massive step in managing their condition. And that's something that, you know, in 10 minutes doctors are not, you know, able to really go into. But if you've got a bit longer, you can chat about that kind of thing and say, you know, sometimes changing the lifestyle is helpful. I would say definitely, you know, keep that broad mind, that broad picture. And if somebody is coming to you just for dermatological stuff, but they mention they've also got migraines, they also have IBS, you maybe see a whole list of diagnoses on their chart that has, you know, potentially inflammatory things involvement, you might start to have that awareness that this person might be an MCAS person, and then maybe thinking about how you can tailor things to them, thinking about the plasters and the dressings and the alcohol that you use, and, you know, is it fragrance free? Is it sensitive? Is it hyperallergenic? You know, just having that awareness of your the things that you use, and, you know, whether there's excipients, whether there's colorings, whether there's flavorings, having that awareness of of those types of things that can really impact somebody with MCAS really adversely, inadvertently. You know, healthcare professionals don't mean to do any harm, but for someone with MCAS, if we give them, you know, dressings that are not hypoallergenic or, you know, those kind of things, they can be reacting. And I think as well, being aware of your environment that you're in, are you wearing perfume? Have you used air freshener in your clinic? Are you, you know, using bleach and fragranced cleaning products? All of these things are genuinely quite serious barriers to accessing healthcare support for people with MCAS. So just by making some small changes to your environment, going fragrance-free, using fragrance-free products, it really does help people who have MCAS, who might be accessing your services, to be safer and more comfortable in your clinic.
Thank you for that. I think those are quite good points that you've made. And, you know, I think sometimes people just aren't aware of, like, oh, I've put on a nice, lovely perfume and, you know, maybe gone to go see a patient and not realized, oh, actually, that's, you know, quite overwhelming for that person. For us, if we were, let's say, wanting to, you know, signpost a patient or, as you say, access the resources that you mentioned, like the healthcare professional guide and things like that, how do we go about finding that information? How do we, you know, kind of signpost patients to that? And if there are things like, for example, you know, research things or things that maybe patients or ourselves would want to get involved with, how do we go about finding that information?
Yes. So as I said, you can email us directly if you've got a query at the info@email address. We also have a website, which is www.marcellaction.org. And in the top sort of banner across the top, we have a healthcare professional section. So you can go to that page. And what you can do is if you click on the healthcare professionals page on our website, at the top, there's a bubble that says join our network. So we have a health professionals network and you can sign up with your email address and then you get a quarterly newsletter from us with all the latest research and information for healthcare professionals and all of our resources. So anything new that we publish, we will signpost to in our newsletters. So that's the very best way to keep up to date with the developments and any information. And also, you can just download those resources as well from our website. So you can signpost your patients to our website. There's a section for them that says get help, and that's for the patients. So there's resources on there. There's the booking links for our webinars and our you know, events and things. And then within the healthcare professionals tab, there's also a resources tab, a drop down. So you can click on the resources and then that page is full of all of the resources that we've provided, and you'll find the healthcare, the primary care guide in there. And also there's a surgical and anaesthetic guide as well, because that's another issue for people with MCAS. Having surgery and anaesthesia is obviously tricky. Painkillers can trigger MCAS. Anaesthesia can trigger reactions for people. So there's a guide on there as well, which is very useful. So I hope that you can find, but if you have trouble accessing things and can't find it, the best thing to do is to email us, because we're always so, so happy to share information. That's never a problem.
Well, thank you so much for joining us for this very short introduction. Hopefully we'll be hearing or seeing from you soon. And thank you for sharing with all the resources and the things that your charity does and raising the awareness about mast cell activation syndrome. So thank you again for joining us.
Thank you so much, Molly. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. For further information on the BDNG, visit our website, bdng.org.uk, and watch out for the next BDNG podcast, which is coming soon.